Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We're back on the road this April with our live show, Cocaine Cowboys. If you want to hear the story of Ireland's love affair with Colombian powder and those who made millions in the gold rush, join us in Galway's Town Hall Theatre on Saturday, 6th of April, Killarney's INEC on Saturday, the 13th of April, and in Belfast's Waterfront Studios on Saturday, the 27th of April. Tickets from venues or at mcd.ie.
One of the most important things you can do to somebody on the street is acknowledge them and not step over them and treat them with contempt. We don't really know what the outcome will be like in 10 years' time in terms of mental health and in terms of physical health from regular drug use, because it is a relatively new middle class phenomenon. It's always been there, but not at the scale it's at now. There's a higher prevalence of people in prison from deprived areas than there are from middle class areas, no question.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. He's the CEO of Merchants Quay Ireland, with a lengthy career behind him in the prison service, making him perfectly placed to understand and to empathise with the complexities of long-term addiction. Later this year, the first injecting rooms will open at the Liffeyside facility, and Eddie Mullins hopes the pilot programme will prove that giving addicts back some dignity will help with the public perception of them. Today, I'm talking with Eddie about his career, about his experiences with the marginalised of society, and about his hopes for the future of addiction services. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. We were going to start with the new injection rooms, basically, which are coming on board up in Merchants Quay. Pull your microphone into you a little bit so people can hear you as clear as possible. But September, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I saw you describing somewhere that these are going to be like those COVID injection, the vaccine rooms. So they're just private areas where people who are long-term, unwell drug users can inject safely.
Yeah.
And this is going to, I suppose, negate the likes of overdoses happening on the streets, which are putting pressure on the health services.
Absolutely, and that's a really good way of putting it. Like, I suppose in its very essence, it'll look like a vaccination centre. So we'll have 7 bays. It's in the basement of Riverbank. Riverbank is one of Merchants Quay's facilities on Merchants Quay in Dublin.
So that's literally opposite the High Courts, isn't
exactly.
it?
Yeah. Correctly. So it'll be very suitable for some of people working in the High Court to use that facility if they need it. No, I'm being a bit sarcastic there. The reality is the facility will be in the basement of Riverbank. It'll have 7 bays. We will open for approximately 50 hours a week over 7 days. And at the moment, I mean, if you walk around the city, you will see people who use drugs, using them in very unsafe circumstances, very often in basements or in down back alleys or in underground car parks or in squats. And this facility will now support people who inject drugs in a medical way. So it will destigmatize people. who are, you know, who are looked down upon in many respects by a lot of aspects of society. But it will do so in a health-led approach, with the supervision of a nurse and project workers. And what we see as the biggest opportunity is that it creates that relationship piece with people who are, let's face it, who are really ravaged by the effects of drugs, particularly heroin. And it will give us an opportunity to start that conversation with many of those clients and hopefully start the journey to recovery. And I know that sounds very notional and aspirational, but the reality is every recovery journey has to start somewhere. Mm. And these are some of the most hard to reach people, who have, you know, a huge sense of mistrust with society, with Ireland, who are, you know, as I said, ravaged by the effects of drugs. And I mean, I suppose it'd be important for me to stress, Merchants Quay don't support drug use. We support people who use drugs. And there's a very clear distinction there. Like, we see firsthand every day the devastation that drug use, particularly prolonged and, you know, poly drug use has on people. And we are very well placed to support people. We provide a variety of services right across the organization to help people at whatever stage of addiction they're in. So it's a really good opportunity.
And it'll mainly be heroin users, will it? Is that all that's been injected?
So, I mean, there are other drugs that can be injected. So it's an injection center.
Yeah.
So it's not restricted to heroin,
so
but it is.
People do inject crack, yeah?
Yeah. So, and for those people who inject, this facility will be a supervised facility for them. But yeah, it is primarily heroin, let's be honest about it. But very many people who use heroin also use other drugs as well. So it's a very complex world, as you know yourself.
And kind of sort of really problem heroin users. Now, there are some, by the way, working in the private sector as well who can just afford it, isn't there?
Well, yeah, there are. But
Some.
But the vast majority of people who use heroin are in dire straits.
Yeah.
Okay, so heroin is a very devastating drug. So, you know, we probably can say that there are people who hold down, you know, employment and who are, you know, for want of a better word, bastions of society, but they're few and far between.
They're the minority.
They are,
of course.
Yeah.
But it shows maybe that with other elements, for example, with employment, maybe with a support system behind you and all the rest of it, you can kind of live while taking heroin. You can operate while taking heroin. The biggest problem I think we see is the physical taking of heroin. We see that as a society as the problem. And, you know, you hear the business community at the moment talking a lot about laneways being closed and antisocial behaviour going on. And that's the kind of thing they're talking about. There's this shame that's attached to people who are taking heroin. They're going into dark alleys to take it. And I think as a society, we see that and nothing else. We don't see the bigger picture.
You know, unfortunately, that is the situation. And what we really need to do is change the attitude, change the rhetoric, because it's a chronic illness. And I mean, I use the example, and it would never minimize any illness or anybody's pain or suffering. But if you took 10 cancer patients and put them on the steps of any part of Dublin and had a campaign, it would be, there would be huge empathy, and rightly so, and huge support. And yet, if you put 10 chronically addicted heroin addicts on a step, people act with disgust and they turn their back on them in many respects. And I mean, it's difficult to compare, but when you look at, we'll say, addiction in terms of a chronic illness, which is what it is, then is it really any different than any other addiction? And if you look at, I mean, I would look at some of the statistics there around deaths through, we'll say, not necessarily overdoses, but drug-related deaths. And we go back to 2021, I think was the last statistics I was looking at. There was over 400 deaths related to drugs and to addiction. And if you look at the same number of road fatalities, for example, and I remember doing an interview the morning after the fatality, one of the road fatalities last year, and I was really struggling to have a conversation because it was so fresh in my mind. It was young people that had passed away. It was a horrendous tragedy. The nation was really reeling from the impact of it. But we have that in addiction quite regularly, and we don't get the same sense of crisis or tragedy or, you know, empathy that we have for other young people, other deaths involving young people, you know.
We don't see them as people.
We don't see them as people.
Do you know what I mean? We see them as sort of, you know, some people see them as, you know, as dirty.
Yeah.
People see them as problem characters around what should be nice parts of Dublin in particular. Why are they on the boardwalk? Why are they here, there and everywhere? Because they've nowhere to go. But as regards death, like what do heroin addicts die from?
Well,
apart from obviously the obvious answer to that is the overdose, yeah. Right? But apart from that.
So the reality is with most drug use, chronic drug use, it impacts on the body. So the mortality rate, for example, for people who use drugs regularly and are addicted is much lower. I don't have the statistics, but it is out there. The information is there. It's much lower than the average healthy person. So usually what happens is when somebody is chronically addicted and continuously using drugs, their body starts to break down. So they can develop chronic illnesses as a result of the drug use, which, and very often then when we come to an inquest into the death of somebody, the primary issue of drug use may not actually form part of that autopsy. So it would look like it could have been a heart attack, whatever it might be. But prolonged drug use has a huge impact on the organs of the body. And, you know, and that's generally, people start to drift into chronic illness as a result of their drug use.
The
does
organs,
that make sense?
It does, as the organs start to fail.
Absolutely.
Do they also perhaps get sort of sepsis and stuff from the injecting and the use of dirty needles and all that?
Of course they do. And, you know, I suppose one very positive development in recent years has the whole aspect of needle exchange, where people don't no longer need to share needles. I mean, when we look back not that many years ago, people sharing 3, 4, 5 people sharing the one needle over repeatedly. So needle exchange has had a huge impact on bloodborne viruses and passing on those kind of illnesses. So the prevalence of those illnesses and sepsis as a result have decreased. I don't have the statistics. The HRB will provide you with all the information around, you know, bloodborne and sepsis. But yeah, absolutely. It is a consequence of using needles.
Sepsis seems to be, in the overall healthcare system, not as big a killer as it used to be as well. There seems to be more sort of ways of treating it.
I think, you know, again, I'm not a clinician, but my understanding is sepsis, like every other, it's a preventable disease. So good standards in terms of healthcare can mitigate the impact of sepsis, I would imagine. But don't quote me on that, as they say.
But long-term drug users basically are in and out of the hospital system. That's fair to say, between, you know, issues like, you know, ulcers, organ failures perhaps, or certainly illnesses around that, and also through accidents and probably involvement in criminality to feed it can result in sort of bust ups and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there's no value put on that, I suppose, what the cost of that is to the hospital system, because I think people are always very much more willing to accept new measures to help when they see that they're going to be cost effective to them.
That's a very good point. And I actually think we should really put a greater value on supporting people in addiction through, you know, bespoke addiction services like Merchants Quay and Anilifi and other organizations who are there to help people on the recovery journey, because there is an impact on the health service, no question about it. You know, and we look back to November of last year where we had a spike in overdoses and the ambulance service responded to several overdoses. And in a really professional and, would say, compassionate manner, the ambulance service, like most emergency services, are very familiar with the marginalised people and nearly have a relationship built up over so many years. So they're very, very well-placed and very compassionate in their approach. But absolutely, diverting people to, we'll say, overdoses or issues in relation to drug use is diverting people away from other services, you know. So there's no doubt about it.
Everything you do preventative, I think, has an impact.
Has an impact.
But it isn't as obvious to see as.
And I think we need to talk about that far more. And, you know, the reality is, while we're talking about specifically now talking about heroin and talking about their injections facility. When you go to other parts of Merchants Quay, like our recovery in High Park, for example, or maybe down in Tullow, and you see people who are on a journey out of addiction. Now, it's a lifelong journey. Never underestimate the effort that is required to, you know, live with your addiction in a productive and a sustainable way. It's very, very challenging. But you can see the outcome. You can see the results. You can see where people have turned their lives around. And like, I have never met anybody in chronic addiction ever who said they were happy with their life or happy with the way they're living their life. You know, they never wanted to be in this situation. They have huge concerns about family and children and if they're going to live that same life. They really, I won't say detest, that's too strong, but they hate where they are. They want to be in a better place. Getting to that better place is a big challenge. It's a big issue. They need lots of supports. And you'll find if there's one aspect of it missing, so if you haven't got secure accommodation, employment, even though people are not necessarily ready for employment, but if the opportunities are there, that's a huge gateway out of drug use. Even the likes of judgment, you know, we talked about stigma. Like, if you treat a person like a dog, you know, I'm not saying they will act like a dog, but how can they think anything more of themselves, you know? Like, I remember being asked a question last week about, you know, giving to the homeless, for example. Do you believe in giving somebody money on the street? I personally do, but I've always been of the, and I've had loads of debates with friends about, you know, I'm happy to give it to a charity. I don't believe in giving it to the person on the street. And I said, well, look, who are we to decide what that person, if you are happy to donate to somebody, well, then you should be accepting in whatever way that's spent. And I think I said as well, I remember Peter McFerry talking about one of the most important things you can do to somebody on the street is acknowledge them and not step over them and treat them with contempt and show some dignity and respect. And that's all part of this attitude we have in society to people who are on the margins, I think.
I remember talking to a counsellor years and years ago, probably 20 or 30 years ago, who was working kind of, you know, within the services and was a very experienced person and told me at the time that he had never once come across a heroin addict or user that didn't have trauma in their background.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's no question about it. I mean, the reality is, unfortunately, you know, a lot of people who are in addiction would have had family members in addiction, maybe parents in addiction, so they would have witnessed that. They would have grown up with the trauma and the
loss of childhood, really, that's, you know, bad parenting.
Yeah, and I mean, I can even remember looking back at, you know, my childhood and families who had, may not have been drugs, but certainly alcohol was a big factor. And you could see the loss, as you say, of childhood and the deprivation, and because something has to pay for these things. So something has to give in order to sustain or to live that lifestyle. So there's no question about it. Childhood trauma is a massive factor. Mm. And I mean, when we look at, you know, we've had conversations about last year about the issues that went on in Dublin, and, you know, particularly I heard lots of conversations around the we'll call it the riot in November. And I, like everybody else, was mesmerised, watching it online, looking at all the various behaviour. And I picked out a particular group of young lads. And I saw my experience working with both young people and you know, working in the addiction services and just observing is that there are a cohort of young people who are definitely detached from society. Detached from society for a variety of reasons. In many cases, they've watched their parents struggle. Their parents absolutely feel, you know, nobody cares. And that sense of resentment, the detachment from society, is very easily tapped in on. Mm. So if you have people who are organising, who have a particular philosophy in life, whatever it might be, they see this group of people as very vulnerable. I don't believe them to be evil, bad people. They're not, I'm talking about the young lads now, they're not particularly bad people, but they are very vulnerable. And I did a talk in a school there recently, and the group, and it was transition students, and we were talking about drug use, but we were talking about society in general, what they wanted. And I came away thinking, you know, really, we don't really know, even though we were all young people, we don't really know what they're going through now. Like, one lad talked about walking home from school and dodging everything, trying to dodge so many things walking home from school because his mother was petrified, you know, that he'd end up going on the wrong path. And they're vulnerable. There's no doubt about it. They're vulnerable people, you know. So
feels like there's more around.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
there's more money around, isn't there, in the drug industry? And I think we agree on the, you know, that mantra, certainly of mine, and I know I've seen you say it a lot as well, is that, you know, it's the middle class drug users who don't have to live in these areas who are funding the whole thing.
Well,
you know, there's lots of it.
No doubt about it. And like the reality is, the people that I know that are in chronic addiction, they don't have money, okay? And in not in all circumstances, but in a lot of circumstances, the means for them to sustain, which is really not a nice word, but to sustain the addiction that they have, is to hold on to extra quantities of drugs or to distribute extra quantity of drugs. It's the people with the hard cash, the middle class, hard cash that can hand over the funds that sustains the lifestyle. You know that. Mm-hmm. You've written about it several times yourselves. And everybody accepts it. But nobody does anything about it, really, you know. You know, or I don't see any evidence of.
Well, I think it's easier for them as well because they can go home after, you know, a Thursday or Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, whatever their weekend is, and go home to their middle class areas where they don't have to walk out the door and face the realities of that, which people have in other areas of the city and the country have to do with people who aren't going out buying. And funding this have to face into living in it and rearing their children and having to tell them to avoid,
absolutely,
you know, 25 being things under, on the way home from school.
Being under the pressure of you know, what goes along with that. And I think what I would like people to is to be honest and open about it. So we're very judgmental. Like, so we, for example, you mentioned, we'd say businesses in the city and the impact, we'd say, of the lifestyle that certain people are living in the city, how it's having on businesses. But yet, an awful lot of, particularly the hospitality businesses, if you go in, you'll see that the middle class clients who are handing the money over are using the facilities to take their cocaine or whatever. So that's kind of double standard. So the poor, unfortunate person out on the street who doesn't look well, who might smell, who might be loud, whatever it might be, is a nuisance, right? But the guy who's in, the middle class guy who's in and he does his line of coke in the toilet, but he's paying for his whatever drink he's having, is okay. Mm-hmm. You know, so there is a real double standard there, and which
and those people probably, and they don't have the same healthcare needs as the people on the streets have. They don't have probably any healthcare needs because most of the middle class users of cocaine either don't believe themselves to have an addiction or can afford it. And maybe while it is having an impact on their personal lives and their families, it's not causing them to go out and rob and things like that. But go back to Merchants Quay and people, you know, we see gatherings of men and women outside Merchants Quay hanging around in a sort of almost teenage fashion. If you park up, if you're going over to the court, sometimes you'll have interaction with them, you can chat to them. It's always a lighter conversation when they have had their fix than when they're needing it, right? So that's the way of it. But who are these people and how long are they living with these addictions? Is there any people alive going in and out of Merchants Quay that got addicted during that first wave of heroin in the 1980s?
So my gut feeling is I'd say no. I'd say many, many, many of the people who first accessed the services of Merchants Quay back in the 80s and late 80s.
Is it open that long?
Yeah, it's open that long. Riverbank, so Merchants Quay, again, a lot of people look at Merchants Quay and they look and they identify it with Riverbank. We have services across the country.
Right.
So we provide a variety of services for people at particular stages, be it in addiction or homelessness. And what makes Riverbank unique is we describe it as an open access service. So people who are living rough or sleeping rough or who are living in, we'd say, supported accommodation or hostels can access Merchants Quay throughout the day for a meal, for a shower, to see the doctor. And that means that there will always be congregations outside there. So not everybody that you see going into Merchants Quay, for example, is in addiction. There are some people who are in homelessness, who are, you know, some people who are in very unstable accommodation, but addiction isn't their primary issue. Poverty and homelessness is their issue. And you'll see that, you'll always see the present in a particular way. So it is a very unique service from that perspective. But absolutely, and again, I'm not providing you with statistics, I didn't bring them with me, but looking at
I don't like statistics.
Yeah, no. Well,
I much prefer...
You're an observer, like
experience,
myself.
Experience, yeah.
So, and I agree. So my observations, looking at the people who are accessing our servers, who are in addiction, they're all quite young. They're in their 20s and 30s. So there are very few people who are in the 50s and 60s in this type of addiction. Okay, so there might be alcohol issues, there could be other issues, but we'll say that the likes of crack cocaine and heroin, it's primarily, in my experience, a 20 and 30 age bracket, you know. And just the point you made there about, we'd say, the middle class drug use, and don't want to dwell on it, but the one thing that we haven't yet seen is the long-term effects and consequences of this wave of cocaine use among the middle class. So while people who are now using it recreationally at the weekends are presenting themselves, they're functioning, they're getting on with life, we don't really know what the outcome will be like in 10 years' time in terms of mental health and in terms of physical health from regular drug use, because it is a relatively new middle-class phenomenon. Mm. It's always been there, but not at the scale it's at now.
No, and not with the youth, the young, I mean, the teenagers.
Absolutely. So
it's the norm.
Yeah, it is.
Almost, which is
so
scary.
Time will tell, you know, how much of a problem this is going to be for society, you know?
So the 20s and 30s that are coming in addicted to heroin and, you know, polydrug users, obviously, and homeless and all the rest of it. So where are the people in their 40s and 50s? Are they coming out of addiction or are they dead?
I can't say with certainty what the answer to that is. Certainly, a lot of people, I remember, and again, I'm giving you my opinion here, very much an opinion rather than, we'll say, research. But my opinion is based on experience over many, many years working both in the criminal justice system and now working in Merchant Ski. So an awful lot of people, particularly young people who are, you know, in the throes of addiction, they, like criminality in many respects, they get to a point where they can no longer do it. Okay, so there's a lot of, you'll see that I think the highest success rates, for example, in relation to people who are on a recovery program is as people get a little bit older, get a little bit mature, maybe have families, okay? Maybe have a partner who says, I'm not putting up with this any longer. So there are factors that will drive them or help them into a recovery program. But as I say, my observations looking at people who use, particularly Riverbank, it is definitely a 20 and 30 cohort. Between 20 and 30 is the most prevalent cohort. That's not to say that there are not older people in addiction, but the biggest focus would be on that.
And look, I mean, some must die.
Of course.
Some must go into recovery.
Yeah.
And, you know, some must maybe stop using the services or something.
Yeah, the other side is...
Do they get fed up of using the services?
Not so much, but, you know, there are lots of services, probably not... a lot of services, like drug treatment services, in the city, and people do move to different services. So, for example, even from the point of view of if there is an issue with somebody owes money for drugs and the person who they owe the money knows they're using Merchant Ski, they may not use Merchant Ski, they may go elsewhere. So there are factors like that that will drive people away from services. You would like to think, and I mean, I firmly believe that, you know, wraparound services in a recovery program does help people on a good journey out of it. So we can see that in our other services. We can see it in our aftercare services, our family support workers who are helping people navigate through that recovery process. So it's a combination of factors.
You have a better seat than others in the story of many lives that, you know, are start off marginalised and probably, you know, people live out their lives like that. But you were 30 odd years in the prison service and you were the governor of Mountjoy before you became CEO of Merchants Quay. You saw people, I presume, coming in and out. You got to know them.
I did. And, you know, it's funny. A couple of things spring to mind. There was a story that I often meant to tell, and it just came into my head now. And it's just in relation to stigma and marginalisation. I remember very shortly after I joined the prison service, I was assigned to St. Patrick's Institution, and I was on nights one night. And so you do your checks. You go around, you check the cells, you put on the blue light to see, you know, make sure that everybody's okay. And I remember lifting up the flap and there was this young flip, I'd say he was probably in his, probably 19, 20. And he was sitting up in the bed and he was crying. And I was very naive, I didn't know what to do. And said, are you okay there? And he wouldn't answer me for a couple of minutes. He said, everything all right? And he just said, tell me, Ma, I'm sorry. And I said, what the hell am I going to do? And I said, what? He said, just tell me, Ma, I'm sorry. So I wasn't sure. Now, I don't know what he was planning, right? So I called the assistant chief officer at the time who was in charge of the prison. he came up with the key, we opened up the cell. And by this stage, he'd stopped crying. And I was trying to explain to the ACO that, you know, he was crying, and he said, what are you sorry for? Just tell me, Ma, I'm sorry. And he says, why don't you tell her you're sorry? He says, you can ring her tomorrow and tell her you're sorry. Right, right, he says, I will, and all of that kind of crack. And I thought no more of it. He obviously went to sleep. We were satisfied that he was okay. And a couple of weeks later, I was on visits. And the way visits work is the visitor comes in, sits at the seat, and then the officer will give, and when it's over, the officer will give a docket to the visitor, and that's your indication that the visit is over. And I went down to give this docket, and it was your man and his mother. I wouldn't be as chatty now as I am now. So I gave the docket and I said, oh, how are you keeping to the owner? And he said, oh, this is me ma. And I said, hello, Mrs. And I said, John is doing really well. And she said to me, is he? And I said, yeah, yeah. And I was making it up as we were going on. I said, he's doing really well. I said, he's going to school and all. Oh, she said, thank God, right? And I remember thinking, like, this lad was in prison, right? Mm. And just to get a compliment or something positive about him made her feel so proud. Mm. And he really was devastated because the one person that he probably loved most in the world was his mother. He wasn't a father. He wasn't a parent at this stage. And the impact it was having on her, and for her to get a nugget of something positive, I could see she was happy. And it stuck with me for years.
And her pride in that moment would have had a knock-on effect on him.
Absolutely. Mm. And like the reality is, and I suppose it gets back to that point of saying about knocking people. Like this fellow was probably, could be on his third or fourth sentence. It was probably shot that kind of low, we won't call it petty crime, because petty crime is a bit subjective. It depends on the person who is the victim of that crime. They may not see it as petty, but in the grand scheme of things, it was probably a petty crime. But for her to hear something like he was doing well in school, I'd say she never heard that her son was, and I was just trying to be nice, you know, making it up. I didn't know what the guy was doing. But it just stuck with me that when you continuously
positive affirmation
positive exactly
comes back with the same.
So you're asking me then about the prisons. Yeah. I mean,
people going in and out, and I suppose just when you're on that you started off in St. Pat's, like, you know, having had that lengthy career, and you were telling me that you were in nearly every prison system.
I worked in seven.
Like, do you think young people, do you think it's the last thing we should be doing, sending them to prison for the first time? I mean,
yeah. So I do, look, and again, it's always a very controversial conversation, right? Because, you know, statistically, the court service and other service will say that, you know, judges do use prison as a last resort, and that they do try and, you know, use alternative methods of retribution. What's the word? It's not retribution. Of paying your debt back to society. So there is lots of evidence of that. There are a couple of issues that I have with prison, and one is that it's particularly for young men. And again, it's probably unfair to categorize one particular group, but young men who are full of energy, full of very impressionable, very easily led.
Impulsive.
Yeah, impulsive. When you send a person into prison, whether we like it or not, and the prison service, you know, has really evolved over years, so lots of good supports, lots of psychology, education, addiction, all of those services are there, not to the level that are needed, but there certainly is lots of improvement in the prison service. But essentially what you're doing is you're putting people who've committed criminal acts in with people who've committed even more and greater criminal acts, okay? And most of the time that a person spends in prison, they spend it in the company of other people who have engaged in criminal behaviour. So if you look at people, young men, 18, 19, 20 years, who can be idiots at times in terms of being impressionable, being led, being intimidated, being motivated into that behaviour. This is manna from heaven for people who organise criminal behaviour. So I do believe, while we look at the need for prison and we talk about, you know, there has to be a deterrent, we have to find alternatives, particularly for certain types of crime, because it doesn't work. You know, recidivism rates are very high.
What sort of alternatives can we look at, like?
Well, so I remember I spent a day with Restorative Justice Services, which is a probation-funded initiative. Now, restorative justice is not for every crime, no question about it.
Yeah. Right?
But I remember sitting, I sat with a caseworker, and there was a client and a guard, and there was a chair, and the chair is the chair of the mediation, and that person was a retired person who had worked in some, you know, I had a career, but was very well intentioned in relation to seeing how this restorative justice process worked. And the incident that they were mediating over, or the restorative justice practice, was in relation to public order offences. So it was four lads who were in a car. It was out in South Dublin. And there was four lads in a car, and there was a couple of guards came across, and they were acting out, and there was a lot of aggression between the lads towards the guards. And this guy was obviously before the courts, and he was given an opportunity to engage in the restorative justice service. But what struck me was the guard came so open-minded to it. Mm-hmm. Now, it was a female guard, it was nearly like role play. So he talked about why he did this, right? She talked about the impact it had on her. You know, she was doing a job, now, that sounds all very flowery, right? But the outcome was, in my view, we were looking to get an understanding that his behaviour had consequences, and also for the guard to get an understanding of possibly why that behaviour was happening. So I think we just need to be
educational for both sides.
And again,
sides.
Nicola, I'm saying this to you, and I don't have the answers, but I do know one answer, and that is that locking people up is not going to. As a nation, we were never beaten into submission. We're never going to beat people into submission. So we need to find a way to have appropriate sanctions for particular aspects of criminal behaviour.
We have to look for every other way
before
we do it, really, don't we? And prison has to be there for certain members of society who will reoffend and who are dangerous.
Of course it does. And, you know, I've often said, you know, I came across plenty of people in prison who had no interest in rehabilitation, who came in to serve a sentence with the sole intention of going back out to re-energise their criminal behaviour. But I've also met many people who you look at the family situation, you look at poverty, you look at lack of employment, maybe poor education standards, and you start to build up a picture of an individual, and you say, well, you know, maybe if we got a few things right, we could have avoided this in the first place. And I also think, and this is where I think we really as a society have to get it right, is that the next generation, statistics, you look at the statistics in prison, as far as I can remember, the last time I looked, 50% of all people in prison will have had a family member in prison. Okay, so it's intergenerational.
Yeah.
By the time I retired, I was meeting nearly the grandchildren of people who'd been in prison when I joined. So that is a fact. We can't get away from that. And there are common factors. If you look up, there's a common denominator in many cases. Not for everybody, but in a lot of cases, you'll find it's poverty, it's addiction, it's poor education, it's lack of opportunities. And they are concentrated on certain postcodes in the city. There's no question about it. There's a higher prevalence of people in prison from deprived areas than there are from middle class areas. No question about it.
And what happens, people in addiction, like those people that are using the merchant's key service when they go into the prison system? Because from a healthcare point of view, they can actually find a place to come off drugs that they might have been desperate for, that they might have missed the boat at a particular moment, because I think you do have to grasp somebody in addiction at a particular moment and have something available for them, which isn't in this country, obviously. But so from a healthcare point of view, they can go in and it can be a positive place, the prison, they can come off drugs. But all those other factors you've talked about for addiction are probably really stark when they come out.
Yeah.
The family, relationships, job prospects, homelessness, etc.
It's funny, it's not, again, funny is certainly not the word you would use to describe this, but I have met people who I would have known in prison, so prison provides stability, prison provides a bed at night, nutritional food, medical care. There are, no question about it, still drugs in prison. People still use drugs in prison. There's a problem. Prison service wouldn't deny that themselves. There's a problem. You know, they're relentlessly trying to deal with the issue of drugs going into prisons. So the issue of drug use is not dissimilar in the community than it is in prison. Maybe slightly different, but not really. There's still big issues there. But the other factors around positive healthcare, nutrition, sleep, you know, even occupying the mind. So if you look at a lot of, you mentioned the clients that we'd have on the keys, like they're all very much in a similar situation, right? So if you can imagine the conversation, even everything is about addiction, it's about how we get our drugs, the whole situation. Whereas in prison, you have an opportunity to go to education. You might have an opportunity to see an addiction counselor, psychologist, whatever it might be. So there is positive aspects, imagine saying this, of prison for people who are in chronic addiction. The flip side of that is, and I've seen this, I've been shocked by it. I've seen people who, I'm not shocked anymore because I'm, what, 7 or 8 months out of the prison. But I remember 3, 4, 5 weeks after leaving the prison and going into Merchants Quay and meeting guys that I'd known 2 months previous, and the deterioration in their health status, their the way they presented themselves was stark, you know. And if you think about it, I remember one of the, I get the train to work every day and I walk along the quays, and one of the mornings I was walking, sometime in December, I remember coming across a client who had been using, who uses Merchants Quay, and he'd been in prison, and he was sleeping under a pallet, right? Mm. And it was on the usher's quay. And like I was saying, how could you maintain a healthy body or healthy mind in such circumstances? So yeah, in many cases, what I've seen is people falling off a cliff very quickly after they leave prison because of the lack of, and both in terms of what we do as a society, but also prison forces people to eat. Mm-hmm. I don't mean physically, but the opportunity.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're on the street,
but people are feeding them, I suppose. They're not having to physically go and do that themselves and find the food and cook it and, you know, think about, you know, what's going into the food. And like, addiction is really time consuming.
Yeah. But what it is
takes up the whole day and night.
But what it does is, you, instead of concentrating on life, you just concentrate on the addiction. So it is about, you know, the need to have the next batch of drugs because the consequences of not having them are so stark. So everything that the person concentrates on is how to sustain that. And sustain, again, suggests that it's positive. It's anything but positive. It is an obsession with not having the pain of not having the drugs.
So that's cold turkey, that physical pain, which heroin obviously is. I mean, crack, is that this similar?
Yeah, physically
painful?
I should be much more au fait with the actual physical consequences. I'm not. It's something I'm getting more, and it's only through talking to people who use drugs and you get a greater understanding of the impact and the effects it has on them. But there are different impacts. Yeah, each drug has a different impact. I think it's too simple to say it's just about the withdrawal. Like it's
a mindset, isn't it? You have to be in the right place, the right
time.
And
like, if you think about,
but you look at any of us going on a diet or something, you can't just do it every day. No. You have to kind of be in the right frame of mind,
and you have relapses, and
of course you do, and you have to be over this particular occasion or that occasion or get through Christmas or whatever.
Yeah, totally.
I don't diet.
And that,
I get that, you know. Yeah,
but that is like,
I try and give up the wine every now and then, and I don't do it
often enough. But that's that simplifies it. But that, like, when you think about, we say a diet, and, you know, okay, if you're grossly obese and there's a risk to your health, I can understand that. But by and large, for the most of the population, dieting is about how you look and you want
discipline.
But if you think about when something has taken over your life, and you're now we'd say immersed in this, and you want to get out of it, but you don't have the tools or the wherewithal or the willpower, and then willpower again simplifies it a bit, but they all kind of help you do that on that journey. And it's just like, it's like a concrete block on your head all of the time, you know.
Can we talk about some of the clients in Merchants Quay and in the services without identifying them? There's enough of them that we're not going to. So kind of like, who are some of them? Where are they coming from? What's their backgrounds?
Well, I suppose I've given you a kind of an idea of, so you're looking at people who are definitely on the margins of society. In a lot of cases, family relationships are broken down, so they're not at home. In a lot of cases, they've been in prison. They might have sold drugs. They might have held on to drugs. So they are in a really dark place.
There are people probably who are more dangerous to themselves than any of the rest of us.
So my experience would be, and you know, I've had this conversation with people. So everybody talks about the green, is the red line Lewis, for example. And so people on the red line Lewis, and the sense of tension and unease, right? And my own experience, and I remember doing a talk recently in the school, and there was a lady talked about her daughter was getting the Lucy from, I'm not sure, some part of, obviously, out towards the southwest city. And she was getting the Lewis in to go to college every day. And she was very, very terrified by the drug use. But it was funny because the lady who was very middle class said to me, you know, and like, she said, you know, my daughter could be, you know, she could end up on drugs because of this. And I said, well, I said, I understand your concern, but the reality is she's more likely to get the drugs from her friends than she is to get it from somebody who's on the loose, who is in addiction, because they'll never give their drugs away.
I'm going to say that. Yeah, yeah. So,
but the other thing was, and I suppose really...
Slightly similar to that myth that drug dealers throw drugs over people's balconies and stuff. I've never known a drug dealer to give it away.
No, absolutely not. But the other thing is, the point I was going to make was, my own experience, and again, I'm coming, like yourself, from being used to this environment. So my threshold will be different to somebody else's threshold in terms of how they might feel or perceive their safety. But I've always found that people, while it can be off-putting because they might be loud or they might be, and they catch your, I'm probably the victim of it more than most. They catch me and they, Nicola, how are you? And you have to
just chat back to them.
Exactly. But for the person who's not used to that, I can understand their perception. But the reality for me, and again, somebody else might challenge this, but the reality for me is most people who are in that particular sphere or that space in the world are more in tune to themselves than they are their environment around them. So they might be loud, they're very unlikely to attack somebody on the loose. They're very unlikely. Again, people are probably going to scream, no,
it's embarrassing. Yeah. But that's a bit decisive.
Exactly. That's my view. Yeah.
But you know, it's a quite an scarily uneducated thing for a middle-class person who's sending their child to college to think that they'd be introduced to drugs on a red line Lewis with all that they have going for them in life, that they're going to be, I mean, that is just so far outside reality, that situation.
And you see, again, that's probably part of the problem, is that there is, you know, a very significant section of society who have no understanding or no need to understand. Like, I've met people who, you know, who their children have started to use drugs and their whole philosophy and their whole attitude has changed because they're now looking at their son or daughter who's using drugs. And they know they're good people. They know they're a good person. Yeah. They know this is a problem. Whereas when it didn't come to their house, this judgment and this maybe lack of empathy and understanding didn't exist to the same degree. So there's nothing like being exposed to a situation to humble a person and to realise, you know, we're all
vulnerable.
Our children are all vulnerable. Totally. And I remember speaking to somebody recently and they were explaining about one of their children that started to use cannabis. And you know, in a way I wasn't much help them because they were, you know, what should I do? And I said, well, the first thing you need to do is be realistic that in the world we're living in now, unfortunately, drug use is very, very common. So driving the person out, screaming at them, shouting at them, doing all that won't change the behavior. So it's conversation. And you know, in a way, it's hope. Hope that it doesn't progress to anything further. Like, it's such a complex.
And you know, those poor feckers on the Lewis are probably the greatest marketing tool against getting involved.
They are.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
In so many ways.
Because you know it very well.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly I would chat to a lot of them, especially going up and down to the courts. We seem to be on the same one on the way up. Same one on the way.
No,
they'd be asking me what I'd be doing, and
it's quite funny.
Telling me all their problems, telling me all the, you know, the.
You can have. I have to say, you know, not to in any way minimise, you know, the devastation of drug use, but there are very funny moments as well when you meet people, like, you know,
but
particularly
there's all
when
personalities in it. I mean, in the same way, people sometimes ask me what are criminals like, and you're kind of going, that's like asking what the human race are like.
No.
There's all sorts of different types of criminals.
Absolutely.
There's bad ones. Yeah. There's okay. Ones, yeah, you know what I mean?
There's
ones.
There is no one descriptor.
Not at all. Yeah. I mean, there's probably a finite number of really, really bad people. I mean, you might know a lot better than I do from your work in the prison service, but.
Well, there certainly are people, no question about it, there are people who control the criminal world. And, you know, and there is that kind of hierarchy without a shadow of a doubt. Mm. You've written about it several times. There's a hierarchy there. There is a huge number of what I would call foot soldiers who are not in any way bad people. They are they're vulnerable. They've been sucked into this life. They don't know how to get out of it. Again, one of the, I suppose, most significant challenges for people in getting in, when you get involved in criminal behaviour is to get out of criminal behaviour. So we look at the drug-related intimidation problem across the country. I remember, I think I've probably told this story several times, but I remember getting a call from a woman when I was in Mountjoy, and she, her son had been attacked, and she was very annoyed that I hadn't told her. She said he was attacked. He required medical attention in the hospital. And so I went through the process with her of what we do. And I said, look, that we wouldn't contact, unless it was a life and death situation, we wouldn't contact family members for a variety of reasons. But also, I mean, a very basic GDPR, medical confidentiality, all those kind of things. And we had that conversation, got out of that. She was quite happy with the explanation I gave. And I said, well, I'm going to ask her now, why was he attacked? And she told me he was attacked because he owed $6,000 for drugs. Right now, $6,000, as you know, $6,000 is a subjective figure that somebody put on a quantity of drugs that might have been worth 200, 300 euro.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant, really. So the quantity was very small. And she was told, she was bringing her grandchildren to school, and she was told outside the school by another girl, came up and said to her, you know, Johnny was attacked in Mountjoy, and if you don't pay the bill, he'll be killed the next time. And she went to a moneylender, which is in many respects not much better than the drug dealer. Went to the moneylender, got the $6,000, paid off the drug debt, and then herself and her daughters were paying the moneylender back out of their social welfare. And I remember at the end of it, I asked her, how was she coping with it? And, oh yeah, and she also said to me that she'd stop bringing the kids to school because she was afraid they'd be attacked in school. So they weren't getting an education.
Yeah.
And I remember asking her she was a very ordinary woman. I said, and how do you cope with this? And she said, well, when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I do is I light up a fag, and then it dawns on me that my life is hopeless. Imagine. And she was much more forceful in what she said, that her life was hopeless because of that. And that's not an uncommon story, you know.
No.
So that's the issue with people when they get sucked into criminal behavior. And that's why I mentioned earlier to you about the whole absolute necessity to work with young people. You know, and going back to that talk in the school, one of the young lads said to me, he mentioned a particular park. He lives in a particular part of the city, and he mentioned a park, and he said, you know, as kids, he said, when I was with my ma, everyone encouraged us to go to the park. Now he says, I'm 15 and they're all telling us to get out of the park. So this was his view of it, he said. And now, that's a teenager's perspective. And I know, I understand that if you asked a group of elderly people how they feel when they see a group of teenagers, you'll get a different perspective. But somewhere in the middle, we need to find a solution where young people can feel that they can express themselves safely, that they are safe. I don't know, be it sport or whatever it might be. There has to be a solution. We can't not say.
No, or maybe have somewhere else to go.
Somewhere else to
other
go.
Other than the park.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Maybe the park is for kids.
We was talking about kicking a football.
Of course.
Yeah.
Did you retire out of the prison service, or did you leave it to...
No, I retired.
The CEO, right, okay. This is why I should have gone into the civil service and retired. Young. I'll be sitting in this seat if I'm still welcome until I'm in my 70s. Anyway.
I'll be in love with it anyway.
So was Merchant's Quay something that was, you know... Were you attracted to it for?
Yeah, so I was for. I mean, I could 2 years before I retired. I was, you know, I'll say in the market to look around and find some new career. I always knew I would go into this kind of a sector because obviously I have an understanding of the challenges and the issues. And I also, I mean, I grew up in the Liberties. In James Street. You know, I was very lucky. I had a. I have 8 siblings, all alive, thank God. Both parents, my father was a hard worker, you know, he had a good job. But we had nothing, like 8 kids in the I was born in the 60s, as I say. So it is, I always had a view of, you know, people, you know, struggling. I've always seen it. And I can remember people coming to the door and my mother would give them something and it might be an item of food or, you know, it could be anything. It was never money because she never had money. But she'd always say, you know, there go I with the grace of God. It's a real old-fashioned saying. But she genuinely meant it. And I'd say I got my values from my parents in terms of, you know, any of us could be in that situation. I also think, you know, I was a teenager of the 80s. I trained as a chef, went off to Rockwell College, which was a catering college in Tipperary. And I can't say with any certainty, But I would hazard a guess that my life could have gone a completely different path. I know the type of person I am. I would have been easily led. So I think, you know, the opportunities that I were given to train as a chef probably saved me from a very different life. No question about it. So, and I'm always grateful for that. And I don't say that in any patronizing or noble way, but it is something that would often be on my mind. I think I could have certainly been a different person, you know.
It was wild streak.
Yeah. More easly led than wild. I wasn't conscious of, certainly didn't have a wild life.
Yeah.
But I could see myself be, I was the messer in the class. I wasn't academically minded. I certainly, you know, wasn't one for studying. I'd say I was a pain in the ass for teachers. But so I am conscious of, you know, circumstances very much can dictate, particularly in, you know, large urban working class areas. It can very much dictate a person's life. And if you think about it, like, you know, when you're 15, 16, 17, very impressionable, very naive in many respects, can take one or two bad decisions that can really be, you know, can set the course of your life. And I've said that in schools, you know, and you're always conscious when you're talking to a group of lads, you know, to set the conversation at the right level and not to be, you know, telling this is what you need to do. So I always try and use what my childhood and my teenagers and my adulthood was like as an example that you can make one or two decisions that'll have, you know, incredible consequences for you going forward.
And obviously there was something else instilled in you, and that was a clear view of what was right or wrong.
Look, no, I'm certainly no saint. You know, I wouldn't put it in such terms as what's right and wrong, but I think, you know, I do think I've always tried to do the right thing. You know, particularly for people, you know.
Well, that's exactly what I mean. Yeah. And you know, it's right to give people a chance and to do what you can with your experience to try and help people who are at the, you know, at the most really, marginalized.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, again, very often it's several chances. It's not one chance. You know, that's the reality of people.
That's where you need a bit of patience.
You do. And you know, one thing I have to say, the prison service is, I think, now again, some people would say differently, but I always felt that one of the strong values of the prison service was this non-judgmental approach, okay? Mm. So, you know, and we didn't do a huge amount of research, but there's lots of talk about, we'd say, relationships between staff and prisoners. And for the most part, they're very, very good, you know, and you know, so there is that, look, there's pockets of, in every, you know, walk of life, there'll be clashes and there'll be conflict, but by and large, there's been a good relationship. And I think that has stood me in good stead in terms of, you know, my older life. When, like, I was saying to somebody recently, I get to come and talk to you, right, and I get to talk and articulate and maybe paint a picture. But when you go into Merchants Quay and you look at people who are sitting, working with, and it's not easy when you're sitting with somebody who is heavily sedated for whatever, and you're trying to bring them on a journey and have a conversation and support them and get information out of them, be sure that, for example, that the person is not in a state of overdose or what they've taken. That takes patience, it takes commitment, it takes absolute empathy and compassion. So I love the job I do. I love working. But when I look at when I look at the young people who we're working with and their patience and their dedication for very little money, it's not like working in these services doesn't make you a very wealthy person. And I'm saying, you know, really, I have an easy job, you know, in lots of respects.
And to go back to where we started, which was these injection rooms, which are a sort of positive going forward, really, as a society and as a city. But it has only come on board now after being met with huge objections. And, you know, what were those, or why are people afraid of that?
You know, I think, first of all, when I came into Merchants Quay, I was presented with, we are now at this point in the MCIF, as we call it, project. And there's a lot of work to be done. And one of the most important jobs for me was to engage with the local community, businesses, the schools, the local residents, and to get an understanding of their concerns. Now, I had an understanding of their concerns because I've had conversations where they've said, you know, we have you know, South Inner City has always been a difficult place. It has had its share of challenges and tragedy. And people are saying, well, why have we now to take on more? So we have, you know, we've seen addiction. We've had children, we've had parents, we have siblings that have lost their lives through addiction. So the most important aspect for me was to listen and understand their concerns and then to try and allay the concerns. So if you look at the international experience of the drug treatment center, or not drug treatment, supervised facilities, is that the presence of people injecting on the street was greatly reduced. So mm-hmm. people were now in. So that vision of a person down the back lane was greatly minimized. It was also an opportunity to start to engage with the people, you know. So at the moment, they're in the streets and they're not engaging with anybody, or a lot of them are not engaging with anybody. So they're left really very vulnerable and people know very little about them. So I've been trying to explain to people that not just the health benefits of a medically supervised injection facility, but actually the social benefits and the benefits for communities where people who are, as I say, I won't keep repeating it, who are now currently on the streets injecting, will be in a much safer environment to do it. So hopefully we can continue to get that message across to people. And also, we have our stakeholder forum, which is a group of people who are, we'll call it, affected by the development of the MCIF. And we're trying to keep everybody included in the process and how it's going to evolve and listen to their concerns. And if there are certain things that we can do, like, for example, our outreach team, we're trying to expand our outreach team to engage with people. So you talked about walking along the quays. Mm. So you'd be quite comfortable walking along the quays because you're familiar, but somebody else may not be. What we want to do is our outreach team to spot that person and to maybe walk with them. Mm. Walk to the bus stop with them and stand with an old person who's at the bus stop and reassure them that they are safe. People leaving the church, Merchants Quay Church, a lot of all elderly parishioners, maybe walk with them to their cars. They're only simple measures, but they can build a bit of confidence in the community and show that, you know, that it isn't a lawless environment. It isn't an unsafe environment.
It's the attitude that these drug users that need this facility aren't necessarily part of the community. They're coming in from outside areas.
Well, there's a perception of that. The reality is, we look across other jurisdictions, they're not. There's a phrase called the honeypot. It's not the honeypot. So, yeah. And the capacity of the facility is also quite limited. So we can't have hundreds of people queuing come in because we won't have the capacity to do that. But I there was a point I was going to make there in relation.
And not everybody will want to.
No. So, like, there's some people who are you know, sceptical and suspicious of a facility like that. But the other part of the piece that I should have mentioned, Nicola, was that the people who use drugs and use this centre as well, we are working with them to say, look, your behaviour has an impact. You know, your behaviour can jeopardise the future of a service. So there is, while people who are in addiction, particularly in the chronic stages of addiction, struggle actually with, you know, with comprehending what their behaviour or the impact of their behaviour is. We're trying to work with our clients to say, look, you need to be more mindful of your environment, of the people and your and the effects of your behaviour. And like, this is a long game. Right?
Yeah.
So we hope that we will start to see, and we're confident we'll start to see behavioural changes and build some confidence with the community around what the facility is aimed to deliver.
So it works both ways, really.
It does.
Because I think people, the public, have to stop being frightened by what they don't understand. And maybe to do that, you probably have to educate yourself and listen to some of this, of what you have to say about it and the kind of people that are, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, for everything I've said, there will be a counter argument by somebody else. And I understand that. And that's the great, you know, that's the wonderful
democracy
at its best. But I think I don't think, of course, you would say this, wouldn't you? But I don't think anything I've said is unreasonable. I think I've always, even when we talked about criminal behaviour, I've always been of the belief that you can never talk about people in prison and, you know, and talk about the plight of prisoners without talking about people who've been the victims of crime, because, you know, for them, the trauma is lifelong as well. So I understand that. But my mother had another phrase, two wrongs don't make a right. So we need to address both.
Is it going to be the first and only injecting service in the country?
So it's a pilot.
Yeah.
So it's an 18-month pilot. It will be obviously monitored and reviewed throughout that 18-month period, and then obviously it's the review and the findings will formulate policy going forward in terms of whether more facilities are required or does the facility need to adapt to the trends in drug use. So,
yeah.
But I suppose the really positive piece to take from this is a major shift, a culture shift, a major shift in terms of how we work with people who use drugs, particularly those who inject. So the actual impact will be significant, but the impact on us as a society and how we think about drug treatment, there's a seismic shift there as well. That's, I think.
And I suppose finally, do you see there being a two-tier drug problem in the country? There's where you're working in is one tier of it. It's where there's, you know, nobody's getting rich.
Yeah.
You know, people are getting sick and it's the probably lower end of things. And then there's another tier completely where the likes of Daniel Kinahan has become a billionaire and middle class people have created that.
Yeah. Well, I you know, you left the scud to last here, Nicola, because I suppose one of the conversations that a lot of people have been having lately is around the Citizens Assembly and the decriminalisation, for example, of drug use. And one of my concerns with the decriminalisation piece is that for many of the people that I work with or that we work with across the sector, their drug use is supported by low-level criminal behaviour. Okay, so shoplifting, whatever it might be, or carrying larger quantities of drugs. And you can keep a certain amount and you distribute the other amount, as I said earlier. So for them, the decriminalisation piece will make no difference, in my view. Now, I stand to be corrected on that. And I have read quite a lot on it, but I still think there's a significant group of people who, at the lower end, as you described, of the
drug market,
we call it, will still end up having to engage in criminal behaviour. But what it will do is middle-class drug use will be decriminalised and we won't have the same. Yes, that's my view. But what do you think?
So they'll benefit.
Well, yeah. Look, you know, I
don't think there's very many people out there policing middle class drug use.
Probably not. No, but
they're policing at a very high level. The suppliers of that,
sure.
And you know, that's a completely different story. Yeah. And obviously, that needs to be funded. And you know, that's not a healthcare problem. That is a greed.
Oh, that's issue. Pure and simple. Pure,
I suppose law enforcement and but as regards the users and the demand, I don't think they'd be. They are worried about anybody coming in and arresting them for.
No, you're probably right, and I think it's the statement that decriminalisation makes is as important as the impact of it. So, because we are traditionally everything has been funneled through the criminal justice system, anything to do with drugs. Mm. This now, you know, differentiates between somebody who is using drugs and gives them the opportunity in a health-led approach. So it's a very positive development. I just have one caveat in the back of my mind in relation to people very much on the margins who still engage in criminal behaviour to try and maintain that habit. That's all. But I think but you're right. It's the haves and the have-nots. And, you know, you mentioned the infamous name there.
Yeah.
I mean, the reality is, I think the circle is the wagons are circling there too.
Almost certainly. And like, I mean, it's fascinating to see somebody, you know, and that really has been what the cocaine boom funded by middle-class money is all about, to see somebody who came from a place not far from where Merchants Quay is, the Oliver Bond flat complex, who started out as essentially running street dealers. And in the course of my lifetime and in really two decades has become a billionaire on the international stage. That's also got, you know what I mean, like everything. It's not as simple as that.
No.
His father
has paved
the way. Can I just say
one thing though? Because, you know, so many people who came out of Oliver Bond or anywhere else didn't end up like Daniel Kinahan.
Yeah.
And might have been on a similar path, you know, at a young age, but ended up some dead, whatever it might be, because of addiction. So he is an outlier from his community.
He's thankfully an outlier in the global drug trade.
Absolutely.
There aren't too many Daniel Kinahans.
No.
It just so happens that, you know, he came from our city and he's representing it,
dispute any of that,
But, I mean, there's obviously other reasons that he became what he did and, as I said, largely because it was paved the way by his father. I mean, he was handed, you know, he inherited something that was already massive before he made it bigger. But, you know, it is, I always see it as such a stark contrast because I have been, you know, while I have seen people in addiction on the streets, I've also seen the wealth right up close that these guys have. You know, they've driven past me in the Lamborghinis. I've seen the, you know, I've seen the amount of designer products that they collect. I've seen the houses they live in. I've seen the way they live. And the contrast is just so stark. Yeah. And for me, it's like, why would you want that for your hometown or want to have been part of that for your city?
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, claim to be proud of your city and to be a proud son of Dublin. Like,
I know. Oh, look, it's very, there's a lot of contradictions in what you've said. Mm. There's no question about it. And I think, you know, you look at, we'd say, vulnerable young lads who see that. And because maybe of looking back at poverty, looking back at parents struggling, all that's like, oh God, you know, I could have that. That's always the worry. And that promise is always given too. So the next
layer... Well, they see that in the communities, don't they? You know, they see it. And it's that impulsivity of that age group. And they want something now. They don't want to have to work for it.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a generational thing there as well. Completely. Across. But I suppose my final comments on Merchants Quay and all of its clients and people it deals with is that I would see each and every one of them that they have a story, and if, you know, we give them time to listen to it, we maybe will get a greater understanding of why the world is the way it is.
I agree. And you know, and again, we didn't touch on, you know, too many personal stories, but one is more harrowing than the next when you sit down and, you know, and you know when you see it. Yeah, it's a start. It's an eye opener.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Eddie Mullins, thank you very much.
Thanks, Nicola. Thank you.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com, produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Clodagh Meaney. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review, or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.